2025 Sanlam Financial Confidence Index has just been released, and the results have been very interesting. On the one hand, financial confidence has actually increased to its highest level in 3 years. I think this is understandable given the decreasing interest rate environment. However, what is concerning is that this increase is not translating into an improved sense of financial well-being. Despite improved confidence, 74% of South Africans remain stressed about their daily finances. I think it's worth unpacking these results to better understand what is really happening at the household level regarding our finances and how we can use this recovering macroeconomic environment to improve our personal financial well-being. I'm consumer financial journalist Maya Fisher-French, and I'm joined by behavioral scientist Kele Boakomo, and Lee Hancocks is joining us virtually from Sanlam Connect. Welcome to you both. I would like to just start by providing some context, perhaps, to the Financial Confidence Index. What does it measure, and what lies behind the significant jump in the index this year? Lee, maybe you can kick off and give us a little bit of background to this.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing is increased levels of confidence within the group that we surveyed. So people are seeing increase in salaries. We are seeing interest rates come down, and that is instilling a sense of confidence that perhaps people didn't feel a year or 2 years ago. There's definitely a rise in people feeling a lot more optimistic about their finances.
Mm. And Lee, maybe just explain to me a little bit about what is it that you're actually measuring. So you're talking about confidence, but what are the kind of questions that you're getting people to answer?
It's around how they're feeling about their finances, their ability to service their debt. Are they feeling comfortable with the levels of debt that they have? Are they feeling confident and comfortable that they're able to plan for their futures? So we look at things across financial confidence. We also test for financial resilience, so their ability to bounce back after a financial setback or something that unexpected happens. So we ask a range of questions that really tries to gauge how they're feeling about their finances currently, how they're feeling about their financial future as well, and whether they're feeling confident enough in how things are working for them currently and going into the future.
And Lee, did you find that given all of these positive economic indicators, that people are now starting to invest more, pay off debt more, you know, is this translating into action?
So I think that's quite interesting. Although we're seeing higher levels of confidence, we may not see that confidence turning into action. So although people know better, they're not necessarily jumping to do better. There may be a bit of a delay in us seeing the actual investments and savings coming to the forefront. So yeah, I think it's this whole thing of knowing better, but not necessarily doing better at this stage.
Kele, I feel like that's the intro for you, right? Because this is the psychology behind money. So what we know is we know interest rates have been coming down, real salaries are increasing, there is a little bit of an economic uptick. So why are we, when we're feeling more confident, yeah. So we're hearing people are feeling more confident, but why is this not translating into actionable change?
Yeah, so I think what we're seeing is this movement from survival mode. We've had a lot of instability in the country, and with all the reprieve that you talk about, it's starting to bring some breathing room. And so I think with breathing room, confidence is the next obvious thing that you will start to experience. However, then there's still a delay between this confidence translating into action. And that's what we're now seeing in terms of South Africans feeling more in control and more recovery mode rather than in action mode in terms of capitalizing on that confidence.
I mean, I think we have to be realistic. We had COVID, which knocked everybody financially. And then we had these rapid interest rate increases. So, I mean, I think the household balance sheet has been wiped out quite a lot. Debt people have taken on debt. So maybe I agree with you. I think there's a sense of, okay, we can start breathing, but now what? And I think that's really what I want to unpack here a little bit is how do we get people to take the next steps? How do we use this opportunity to improve our well-being, maybe not only just financially, but even psychologically? Maybe you want to
So I think the fact that more people report that they are feeling in control of their finances, mm-hmm. that they're paying off their debts and they are feeling in control of their financial situation is a good start, as you said. But then how do we move to the next level? How do we get people to start to make the right decisions and build those behaviors? And confidence doesn't necessarily relate to behaviors. So I think it's really about how do financial services really enable people to turn this relief into routine? Mm-hmm. So how do we make more decisions automatic around saving, becoming more automatic, or just paying off your debts? And how do we ensure that we are helping people understand the progress that they're making and celebrating some of those wins? So I think it's really around how do we bring some of the routines now, because behavior only comes from routines and building it into design.
And, you know, one of the things that I did pick up in COVID was that there was the sense that people started to understand why getting their finances in order was important, especially around things like emergency funds and all of those kinds of things. But I think then we were kind of hit again by the high interest rates. So maybe we will get back that kind of feeling and that, okay, I do need to sort this out, but now I've got the breathing space and now I can move forward. Yeah. But maybe I should ask you this question, because I know that money conversations is a really big theme for you. There's a lot of work that Sanlam's done around trying to introduce these money conversations. And what is behind, you know, how important is it for us to start really talking about money and have these conversations that around the dinner table?
I think it's incredibly important. A lot of us growing up had very different experiences with money. So either we came from a household that didn't have money and, you know, there was always that sense of unease when it came to the end of the month and bills having to be paid, or we came from an environment where money wasn't a problem. So we didn't have those issues. So we all come from different backgrounds, and that means we don't necessarily understand one another when we talk money in a relationship, when a couple gets together, or when you have kids and you want to decide how you want to bring your kids up. So it's so important to talk about money, but it's also as important to understand the background and what we call your money personality. So how do you think about money? How do you deal with financial decisions? Are you a bit more conservative? Are you a bit more aggressive when it comes to making those kind of decisions? So it's really that behavioral thing. It's understanding why you think about money, how you can perhaps change that going forward, and how you can have open conversations around finances and money as well. I think we're a society that doesn't like to talk about money generally, but it's so important that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past with our kids. So we have to learn to open up and share. And then we perhaps learn from one another as well along the line, because you don't know what other people are going through if you're not having conversations about it.
I have to so agree with you, Lee, there. And Kele, to bring you in, whenever I do a little bit of work with people, I ran something with sort of with mentees and that. And what we find is when we put them together and they start to talk about their financial emotions and feelings, they're always amazed that other people are in the same situation as them or feel the same.
Yeah.
Do you think that happens when we break down that barrier, when we start to talk about it, it's like, oh, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I think it starts to remove the barriers around the conversation around money. 67% of South Africans in the research said that they're not comfortable about talking about money. So that's still a large amount of people. But it also depends where you're talking about money from. Some people are talking about it from an empowered state and some not so much. So really understanding where people sit with money psychologically and emotionally is very important in order to reach them. But I think social proofing the conversations and making people talk about their stories is that much more better in terms of breaking down the barriers around money and just being scared around talking about money.
Because shame and fear, those are big around money. And I said, you know, I'll speak to somebody who's made the decision to go into debt review, for example, which is a big decision, and they've taken the decision to take control of their money. But they don't want people to know. They don't want people to know that they were in a position where they now had to get help.
Yeah.
And where does that come from? Why are we so ashamed? I think I've read some research where they said they'd rather put pictures of themselves naked on Facebook than their bank balances. Yeah. Why are we so ashamed when we can't manage money? When, let's be honest, nobody can manage money.
Yeah, I think it's got to do with security. I think people feel secure when money seems to be in place. And the fact that people are not feeling comfortable to talk about it is a less of security. So, you know, in the research, again, I think 75% said they don't feel secure in terms of their future finances. Mm. So it's such a very touchy subject and a very personal conversation around where people sit around their finances. Mm. Going into debt review and asking for help from friends and family is something that we see not coming quite strongly through. But I think it's really about how do we break down those barriers in these conversations.
Absolutely. And Leah, I want to ask you this question. Do you think the financial industry is doing enough to facilitate these conversations? And I'm also thinking maybe, you know, is this a role for financial advisors, for example, to help people navigate these conversations? And, you know, I do think a little bit in, between a couple, you know, there's a couple, a husband and wife, and maybe they're finding it very difficult to talk about money. Is there a way that that can be facilitated or even bring in the kids into a conversation? Do you think the industry could be doing more to help that?
I think that over the last couple of years, we have started doing more and we are telling stories now. I think it's, we're trying to break down that barrier that a lot of people have this perception finances and growing your wealth is only for wealthy people. It's not for the average person. They don't see, you know, having investments as something that I can potentially achieve. And I think the industry, we need to do more about talking about financial planning is for everybody. It's not just for someone who earns X amount or has a certain number of assets. It's for the everyday person. And we need to have more conversations. We need to have more real conversations with people. We see that when we do campaigns around real people and their stories, that resonates. People want to build those relationships. It's not just a brand or a financial services institute that's up there. And we're all down here. So I definitely think so. From a financial advisor perspective, I think it's critically important to have the conversations around money, to understand your client's money personality, the way they think about money, and to adapt their financial plan to their unique set of circumstances. And definitely getting spouse involved, I think, is important because you need to really foster that relationship. Financial planning is about building a relationship with your clients and being there on the journey with them. Financial advisor can play that impartial role, whereas we tend to get very emotional with our partners when it comes to money discussions and what we should be doing and shouldn't be doing. And I think a financial advisor helps keep neutral ground and ask the questions and put the plans in place that work for both equally, rather than one or the other having the stronger viewpoint.
And Maya, you'll see in the research as well, it talks about that more people are having conversations with their financial advisors, which is really encouraging because I think it's the space, as Lee mentions, to remove the fear and more put more facts on the table around how do you get towards your financial wellness.
Mm. And I love the comment Lee was making about that emotion between a husband and wife.
Exactly.
We all have a different opinion about how the money should be spent, you know?
Yeah.
I want to move on now. So, I mean, I think it's really important that people have conversations around money. But one of the things that really struck me in this research was the findings around Gen Z. So this is the age group 18 to 28. They were so much more optimistic and confident than anyone else. You know, is this just a matter that, young people tend to be more confident? Or do you think there's something different about this generation that is giving them that sense of resilience?
Yeah. So Gen Z scored high across financial self-determination, financial resilience, and financial well-being. Mm-hmm. So it is quite interesting that they are feeling so optimistic. But I think they are a generation that seem to have a lot of agency. They are digitally native. So I think when we're talking about advice, they seek advice everywhere. It's available to them via TikTok, via all these platforms that exist. And so they have more access to financial education, I'd say, and they take more control for their outcomes. And I think just that agency just sees a different generation that is driving their outcomes that much more positively. And there's this whole notion you were talking about earlier on around this hustle culture, around how do I take control and ensure that I'm financially independent? And I think this generation really is big on that.
Because it is interesting to me that this is a generation that's facing extremely high unemployment. I mean, our youth unemployment is actually, it's the terrible yeah. statistics around that. Yet you've got this confidence coming through. And what we are seeing is that the side hustle, just the idea of running two or three businesses all at once. And of course, the digital world has made that so much easier. I mean, we've got influencers now, which didn't exist in the previous generations, you know. So I think you're right. I think they are able to take this technology and use it to create income for themselves. I suppose the challenge now is, and maybe Lee, I'll bring you in here. The challenge is you've now got these young people with side hustles. How do we convince them to use this extra money to actually start building wealth and not just lifestyle?
That's an interesting question. In the research that I've done around Gen Z, and I have a 25-year-old daughter, so I see that playing out with her as well, is they really are starting to value experience over having things. So for them, perhaps different to other generations, it's not about keeping up with the Joneses. It's about how do I build this future for myself? Now, we always traditionally were taught that you have one occupation, that's where you earn your income from. We insure people, we insure them based on their primary occupation, and we have to change the way that we're looking at, we talk about the gig economy, where they have all these different gigs. And they're earning money. But I think it's financial education. It's about being where these Gen Zs are on the TikToks, the Instagrams, giving them bite-sized educational information that they can trust. It's coming from a trusted source. Showing them visually how money they put away today can grow into the future and what that means for them. So I think we need to meet them where they are. We need to give them credible education. And we need to explain to them the value of putting money away, the value of compound interest, all of those things, so that they can continue this life of side hustles and earning money from multiple places and not forced into perhaps a direction they don't want to go into because they haven't saved for the future or made those plans early enough.
And I do think there is a challenge actually for the industry to create products that meet them, because you know a lot of the products that the financial industry roll out, I think, tends to be very set along the income, right? The income earner from a single source. You know, if I think about it, so I think that's also a little bit. Let's be honest, that's part of the challenge for the industry, is to keep up with Gen Z and what they're actually looking for. But I want to end off now giving our listeners a little bit of some tools, some real practical ways that they can start to use this uplift in the economy. I must just mention that we've just had the medium-term budget. There was a lot of positivity that came out of there. I was listening to the economists. They're all feeling quite optimistic in South Africa, which is fantastic because in other parts of the world, they're not feeling so optimistic. So how do we tap into that? And what do you think, what kind of behavioral science insights can you give, Kele, to create like habits that are going to help us build build wealth and better our financial outcomes?
So one of the things, again, from the report, it talked about setting financial goals and tracking them. It's one of the things that we see that is quite lagging in terms of the metrics coming out from the research. So one of the things I think that is really useful is this social concept of social proofing. How do we share our goals and how do we track goals collectively within community around our financial goals and well-being goals? I think that's one thing from a behavioral science around how do we actually social proof and use commitment devices between ourselves around these are the financial goals I'm going for and tracking them and celebrating them and having the feedback loops around how we're doing around our financial goals, I think is one thing that can really start to drive the habits around us achieving financial well-being. Mm-hmm.
I love what you're saying about community and accountability. Mm-hmm. I'm just busy reading a book actually about thinking clearly. I think it's Shane Parrish. And one of the things he spoke about was he said, you will pick up the habits of those around you. Social pressure, right? Yeah. So if you were the holler friends where flash and cash and spending and chasing, you know, the Instagram pics is what they value, you're going to find it very hard to be going against that trend. So I think you want to find a community that you identify with and who can hold you accountable and share your wins and share their tips. So it also goes back a little bit to that money conversation again, doesn't it?
It is. I think, again, in the social proofing context, if in environments that you're in as young people, to say, how do we set financial you know, challenges and report to each other how we're doing. You know, that starts to change behavior amongst these groups that we find ourselves.
We see that a lot on TikTok, don't we? A lot of those savings challenges, and it is. I mean, they're actually very, very powerful. Yeah. So we know what social media can do. By the way, social media can do both good and evil. So let's not, I'm not advising anyone to get their financial advice from TikTok.
Exactly.
But Lead, how do you think that the industry, and I did mention a little bit earlier saying the industry is going to have to look at how they're going to engage with Gen Z. So what do you think the industry could be doing to help people make their habits automatic and also to move away from sort of maybe short-term goals like paying off debt to actually starting to look at that long-term, you know, generational wealth building?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons we can learn from Gen Z is digital first. So looking at how can we develop digital tools that will help people track their goals, they're able to visualize it. It's the rise of rewards programs and how rewards programs can help you engage with your goals. So if you reach a certain level, you get a certain reward. So it's looking at how do we integrate all of those things, helping people visualize their progress, you know, encouraging them to automate their savings and their investments so that they know every month that money is going off, it's going towards their goal. But I think it's also encouraging people from Gen Z upwards to engage with financial advisors around those personalized plans. So it's not a one size fits all. It's engaging with the advisor, him or her understanding what it is you want to achieve, understanding how you think about money and putting those plans in place and regularly engaging. It shouldn't be, you know, you see your advisor, you buy a product, and then that's it for 3, 4, 5 years. It's that engagement, constantly checking in, making sure you're still on track. And if you're not on track, how do you adjust? Because life happens. So we know that it's not always going to be perfect and everything's going to run according to plan, but it's then how do you reset? Do you grow your financial resilience to get back on track and keep moving towards achieving those goals?
I have to just tell you, Lee and Kele, my favorite stat is net asset value. And I do that every year. So I thought I should share that with the listeners what I do. I take all my assets and my liabilities and I add them up and you get a number, right? Your assets minus your liabilities. And you can track your NAV because whether you are paying off debt, because if you're reducing debt, obviously your NAV will increase, or if you're investing. And I think it's those sorts of numbers that every year you check in with yourself or with a financial advisor, you just say, am I growing a little bit more? Am I better off now than I was last year? Because yes, we're not going to make our millions, you know, in the next 6 months. But if we can see that constant, you know, just those improvements. I mean, are those the kind of metrics that one can use?
Yeah, I mean, I love the simplicity of it as well. It's just around what's that one number that I'm tracking? And that's what you keep yourself honest with. Absolutely. It's also around making things simple rather than complex in how we manage our financial lives.
Yeah,
I really like that.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
I love debit orders, automated debit orders, which with escalations, those little easy things that we can do just to keep us on track. So that's absolutely. And Lee, any last kind of tips that you would like to give from what you've experienced in the index, having a 25-year-old child, knowing both the Gen Z and perhaps the sort of Gen,
exo-millennials?
I don't know where I'm at. But what advice would you give to almost each of those categories?
Yeah, I think it is what Kelly said about keeping it simple. And it's also knowing that you don't have to start with everything. It can just be one thing that you take and you make a change. And then 6 months later, or whenever you're ready, then you do the next thing. So you don't have to be perfect straight away. You don't have to say, well, now I've got the confidence, I must do everything. And it's having those conversations with your millennial children, your Gen Z children. I believe now is Gen Alpha coming up, but it's having those conversations and helping them to understand it's just one thing. If you start with one, then you can build on that and keep building over time.
I just actually just love what Lee said there as well, Kelly, because I think people sit up in January and they say, I'm going to achieve this, and then they're totally overwhelmed. And I just want you to end off with a little bit of the psychology behind that, because I know that self-discipline is very difficult when you overcommit yourself to too many things. I'm going to lose 10 kilograms plus pay off my credit card plus climb a mountain. You know, how should we, going into January, set our New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, I think keep it simple and choose that one thing that you can be disciplined about. Mm. And as Lee said, you then compound on the next behavior, because we know behavioral change is very difficult. That's why we need to keep it simple. So that one metric that you can track for yourself and keep coming back to and then adding on it, I think that's just the simplest way to think about it.
Great. Well, I want to say thank you to both of you for joining us. And just to those of you listening, you are feeling more confident. I know that. That's the sense I'm getting out there. What we now need to do is say, what do I do with this confidence? How do I make sure that I build myself the resilience that I need? Because you know what? We are improving, the economy is improving, but there's always going to be dips. There's always going to be another challenge. So how do we use this base that we maybe have now to build on, to grow not only our short-term and emergency savings and resilience, but also long-term intergenerational wealth? So thank you to both of you for giving us some insights into that.